we'll be able to know what happens right before the crash, what happens during that oh no moment.
Using data recorders on cars for accident investigations. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 9th of November. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a skeptic weighs in on the state's gas line plan.
There would have to be some huge attitude shift on someone's part to want to make that go.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. The Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And by AlaskaDispatch.com, reporting from across the state using multimedia and citizen journalism online to tell the story of our state. Find your Alaskan news at AlaskaDispatch.com.
The Juneau Police Department will be the first in the state to get a crash data retrieval system to read the so-called black box found in most current vehicles. Prosecutors say they look forward to better evidence in serious and fatal accidents where the system is likely to be used. The system and training would be paid for by an Alaska Highway Safety Office grant and local match. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander has the story.
Is that data retrieved with the consent of the car owner or the driver, or is it without their consent?
Assemblyman Randy Wanamaker worries the information download could be an invasion of privacy. In fact, the Assembly tabled the issue earlier this fall, pending the answer to that question.
Essentially, that data is evidence.
Juneau Police Chief Greg Browning says the same constitutional protections apply to collecting this evidence as other kinds of evidence. He says the information a vehicle's computer holds could be essential to piecing together the cause of a fatality. That's where it would be the most helpful, according to District Attorney Doug Gardner, and in most cases, police would still need a search warrant.
I don't think the police are going to be out running around plugging the recorder into cars without a search warrant or without consent. Clearly, if a person believes they were acting appropriately in a crash, they may ask the police to download the information. If, on the other hand, there was criminal suspicion and data was sought by the police, they would come to us, work with us, and we would approach the court for a search warrant.
Gardner says the ability to see what was happening with automobile systems during a crash will take some of the guesswork out of accident investigations. The data will supplement information gathered at the scene and interviews with witnesses and those involved. Event data recorders have been part of a vehicle airbag system for years. Mendenhall Auto Service and Parts Administrator Jim Sims says they're continually updated and now record speed, braking, seatbelt use, traction control.
They could say maybe the ABS system didn't work properly or did work or all four wheels were locked up. It's grabbing information mainly to repair it or to find out why the function didn't work. It wouldn't say a time and a date it happened.
Though the term black box is often used to explain the vehicle recorder, Sim says that's really a misnomer.
If the vehicle burned up, the black box is not going to stay like an aircraft. It's nothing that's going to not melt down or whatever.
Cindy Cashin is administrator for the Alaska Highway Safety Office, which is funding JPD's crash data retrieval system with federal dollars. She says the information police will be able to download is becoming a priority of government safety agencies.
We'll be able to know what happens right before the crash, what happens during that oh no moment. And that is very important, especially with the concern at every level of government and in our communities about distracted driving.
Cashin says the state safety office considers JPD's experience with the system a pilot project. If it's successful, the agency will encourage other Alaska police departments to apply for grants for their own crash data retrieval system. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
Alaskans who have exhausted their unemployment benefits are eligible for 14 additional weeks thanks to legislation signed by President Obama this morning. But the state's unemployed will have to wait until January to find out if they qualify for 6 weeks beyond that. Tom Nelson is director of the Division of Employment Security at the State Department of Labor. He says Alaskans will qualify for the 20-week extension if the state's unemployment rate is 8.5% or higher for the months of October, November, and December.
Right now, our unemployment rate is 8.3%, and we will learn what the next month's rate is for October about the 20th of November.
As of Friday, Nelson says more than 2,000 Alaskans qualify for this latest unemployment extension. If the extension ends up being 20 weeks, some people could get almost 2 years of unemployment benefits total. The federal extensions supplement 26 weeks of regular state benefits paid from Alaska's Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. Nelson says the fund is healthy with a balance of more than $300 million.
Approximately 40 states in the lower 48 are going to be in a situation where they'll be borrowing money from the federal government to maintain their trust fund balances. And we're not in that situation, so we're doing pretty good.
The state's trust fund collects unemployment insurance contributions from both employers and employees. Nelson says the number of unemployment claims in Alaska has risen about 17% in the past year. Senator Mark Begich today criticized Senate opposition to a bill that would expand health care benefits for veterans who served during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The legislation provides support for caregivers of wounded veterans who are treated at home instead of in federal facilities. It would also expand care for female veterans and increase the benefits for those who live in rural parts of America. Oklahoma Republican Tom Coburn has put a hold on the bill, preventing it from coming to a vote by the entire Senate. He says he wants to expand the coverage it offers to veterans of previous wars, and primarily he wants to prevent adding to the national debt. Begich characterizes Coburn as denying services for veterans because he is concerned about the cost.
The bill does not discriminate against any group of veterans. It is not a bill that benefits lobbyists and does not duplicate existing services. And as of Friday, my colleague did not have an alternative proposal available for review, as he claimed just created myths.
Later in the day, Coburn posted on his official website 3 pages of budget cuts to offset the cost of the program. Among them is an elimination of air carrier subsidies for small communities, a third of which are in Alaska, cutting water and wastewater infrastructure projects, and selling unused federal property and buildings. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, finding a solution to a chronic shortage in library funding.
There was a time when the library had 10 branches. We're down to 5, but our population has grown significantly.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983. On the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
A former state petroleum economist is speaking out against the state's current plan for building a gas line from the North Slope to the lower 48. Roger Marks worked for several state governors, most recently for Frank Murkowski, trying to get a gas pipeline project moving. He is now retired. But in a recent article for the Journal of Economic Issues, he details several problems he sees with the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act, or AGIA. Right now, TransCanada and ExxonMobil are working to launch a pipeline project under the state's AGIA license. Marx's main point in the article is that AGIA doesn't give the gas producers, BP, ConocoPhillips, and Exxon, enough incentive to make the project work.
It sets up some commercial conditions that are antithetical to the interests of the shippers.
While TransCanada works under the AGIA process with Exxon, BP and ConocoPhillips are collaborating on a competing project called Denali. Marks says neither entity is spending enough money in anticipation of the open season process when the gas producers agree to ship their gas in the line, allowing the gigantic project to secure financing. Marks says if the producers do commit any gas during TransCanada's open season, it is likely to come with conditions.
The conditions might be, you know, the state has to change its taxes, or we don't like the way TransCanada has configured the project. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things. They could submit conditional bids, and at which point, you know, there could be some negotiations, and those negotiations could be fruitful or not fruitful. And so at the end of the day, and those could even take years. So, you know, I guess I am fairly confident, at least at the first level, they will not receive, you know, a sufficient amount of gas committed unconditionally that TransCanada can take the commitments to FERC and to the bank to get financing and to get the FERC license.
A lot of observers think the TransCanada Exxon project will eventually merge with the Denali project by BP and ConocoPhillips. Do you think that prediction is accurate, or is that wrong?
There are conditions within AGEA that are antithetical to the commercial interests of, you know, not only ConocoPhillips and BP, but Exxon too. You know, ultimately, the shippers or the producers pay all the costs. So anything TransCanada agrees to do gets passed into the tariff structure, which is ultimately paid by the shippers. TransCanada will make money on cost overruns. The producers will lose money on cost overruns because they ultimately pay the cost. So there's a big incentive for the producers to build the pipeline themselves just to contain costs because they ultimately pay the bills. Number two, because of the AGEA structure where, you know, the state picks up 50% of the tab before open season and 90% after, and only up to $500 million. It makes sense for TransCanada to spend money after the open season. And, you know, the way you get a good cost estimate is spending money. And one of the significant causes of cost overruns in these big projects is not spending enough earlier to narrow the uncertainties. You ask, could these projects merge? They could, but there would have to be some huge attitude shift on someone's part to want to make that go.
There's been a lot of talk recently of shale gas reserves in the lower 48 and how that supply might make Alaska's gas unnecessary. What's your assessment of that?
I think that's absolutely astute. No, I think that's a big concern. I mean, it's coming on gangbusters. They find more and more of it every day. It doesn't require the huge capital costs. And even if the per unit costs, may or may not be a little higher than the Alaska cost, the fact that you don't have to lay out the billions and billions and billions of dollars to sell your first molecule certainly gives it a leg up. And it's something that's just one of the stark realities about the commercial landscape for this project.
Do you think Alaska will ever see a gas line?
You know, I don't like to predict the future. I would, you know, in my opinion, I would say, you know, in terms of a dedicated gas pipeline, either LNG or the lower 48, I would say it's the chances less than 50-50. You know, there are certainly other options for commercializing the gas. There's gas to liquids for sure, where you convert the gas to a very clean diesel product and you could put it into taps. And that would, you know, extend the life of taps. It would lower the tariff on taps. And most importantly, in my perspective, you can scale up. You don't have to spend, you know, the $30, $40 billion to sell your first molecule. You can start small or you can start big and see how it goes. So even if there wasn't the big gas pipeline, it doesn't mean the gas couldn't be commercialized in a way where both the producers and the public could make a great deal of money.
Roger Marks speaking with APRN's Lori Townsend. Marks wrote a recent article for the Journal of Economic Issues called Why America May Not See Alaska Natural Gas Soon. Although TransCanada has not applied for any of the $500 million the state has set aside for the project, the Department of Revenue and TransCanada estimate that the company will spend $142 million on the project before the open season next May. Thank you. Anchorage's libraries are in financial trouble, and now a couple of nonprofits are stepping up to the challenge of helping them meet 21st century needs. The Anchorage Library Foundation and Friends of the Library and the municipality paid for an 8-month study on the status of the city's library system, and now they are asking the public to weigh in. The study, prepared by Himmel and Wilson Library Consultants, paints a grim picture of a library future hamstrung by lack of funding. Report author Bill Wilson cited ongoing city budget shortages as a certain threat. Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan's proposed 2010 budget calls for cutting library hours and staff. Karen Keller is director of Anchorage's LUSAC Library.
Well, under the budget that's being considered by the Assembly right now would mean a reduction in our personnel. We would lose about 14 positions. And then in our non-personnel operating budget would be about another $100,000 reduction in our collection budget. The reduction in 14 positions would impact us in terms of service hours. We would be going down to about 90 employees. And so LUSAC would remain open 7 days a week, but the branch library hours would be reduced.
Keller says the library's purchasing funding has remained flat for years, even though the costs of materials have continued to climb, particularly the costs of multimedia materials. It is difficult to meet user demands, she says. Keller says the library just made it through a period of reduced hours due to a city furlough and is now looking at staff reductions if budget cuts go through.
There was a time when the library had 10 branches. We're down to five locations, but our population has grown significantly since then. So as population has grown, our library facilities have declined, and certainly in terms of our ability to purchase library materials and so forth.
In his report, Bill Wilson wrote the Anchorage Public Library is in a struggle for survival. Current funding trends will lead to a library that is at best mediocre and at worst irrelevant. The Anchorage Library Foundation and Friends of the Library are asking the public to attend a town hall meeting on Tuesday evening at Anchorage's LUSAC Library to hear the recommendations of the Wilson Report and to discuss ways to improve library services. A prime focus of the meeting will be generating ideas on how to reduce operating costs and how to secure new sources of funding.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
The Sea Alaska Heritage Institute is sponsoring a series of lectures honoring Native American Awareness Month. The series got underway last week with two talks featuring Southeast Natives reflecting on the land claims movement and statehood. KMXT's Casey Kelly has more.
Former Sea Alaska President and CEO Byron Mallott spoke Monday about the history of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act and the effect it's had on Native people. More than 99% of the land given to Native corporations under ANCSA remains in Native hands today. Mallott says that shows the corporations have stayed true to the original idea behind the land claims movement.
Preserve the land for future generations. It was all across the state at the village level.
But with the discovery of oil in Prudhoe Bay in 1968, Mallott says the major factor in ANCSA's 1971 passage became economics, resulting in the formation of the regional Native corporations.
In my head, I can understand it, but in my heart, I still have a hard time with it, this notion that ANCSA is all about economics.
But he says the corporations don't operate like most for-profit ventures, and he hopes they never will.
If we're smart about it, we can figure out a way to allow the corporations to continue to be meaningful economic engines and the tool, which is the only way I view them. There's nothing sacred about this boardroom. There's nothing sacred about ANCSA. It's just a damn for-profit corporation, a tool that we can use as best we can in order to create some economic opportunity for our shareholders. The essence of who we are lies in the land, and we need to figure out a way to keep that in native hands no matter what happens with the corporate institution.
On Tuesday, University of Alaska Anchorage Professor Jean Breinig spoke about Southeast Native perspectives on statehood. She says Native people shared many of the same concerns as non-Natives, which ultimately led to Alaska becoming the 49th state. Natives wanted more control over their traditional hunting and fishing grounds, and the burning issue in Southeast was the use of fish traps. Breinig says organizations like the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood came out against the traps.
And the way that they got rid of the fish traps, it was outlawed in the state constitution. So that was the hope, that was the promise, and that actually happened.
But it was far from unanimous. Before they were banned, Native villages like Metlakatla, Cake, and Angoon operated traps, and Breinig says Angoon even voted against statehood in 1958 because of the trap issue. She says for Native people, it was less about the use of fish traps and more about control over the fishery resource.
In truth, Native people really wanted access to their fish game located on the land and waters they'd occupied for millennia, and it was less important to them whether it was federal control or state control. It was more about getting back control.
50 years later, Breinig says many Native people are disappointed with how state control over fish and game turned out. She says it hasn't proven to be better, just different. After her speech, she said the issue of subsistence, with dual federal and state control, needs to be resolved, and she applauds State Senator Albert Kukesh for his efforts to do that.
The fact that he's taken that on, and he's willing to put himself out there and take a stand, is good, because we need some resolution on this. We need to move forward on that and get it figured out.
Breinig is Haida, originally from Kasan on Prince of Wales Island. She teaches English at UAA with a focus on American Indian and Alaska Native literature. The Sea Alaska Heritage Institute is sponsoring research she's doing on the statehood issue. SHI's lecture series continues through November 24th. All talks are free and open to the public. Other topics include Southeast Native languages and encounters between area Natives and European explorers. A full list is available online at SeaAlaskaHeritage.org. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Fire protection in Alaska's remote communities depends on a relatively small group of local residents who devote a lot of their free time to staying prepared for the worst. That particular public service is typically limited to people over 18 years of age, but last winter, Petersburg's fire department began signing up high school students for its new junior firefighter program. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein has the story.
I teach kindergarten. And as a volunteer firefighter, you can always count on me to be there for my community.
On a recent drill night at the Petersburg Fire Department, volunteers previewed a new State Firefighter Association recruitment ad.
Call 1-800-FIRELINE and become an Alaskan emergency responder.
The ad features firefighters from several Alaska towns, including Petersburg, which is always in search of new volunteers. Last fall, the local department began looking towards a younger group of potential recruits, high schoolers.
I'm Lauren Yeager, and I'm 17, and I started the volunteer program last, I think, November, whenever it started.
Yeager is one of 8 students in the department's new junior firefighter program.
My family's been very active in the fire department. My dad is one of the captains on the fire department, so I've pretty much grown up around here, so I just wanted to be involved and take part in my community and do something different. So,
is this something that you think if you stayed in Petersburg or came back to Petersburg at some point you would continue doing after high school?
Oh yeah, definitely. I plan on joining when I'm 18, so I hope to do that and continue my experience here.
My name is Bonham Jackson, and actually tonight is my first night being here, so new guy.
What prompted you to get involved?
Well, I guess mainly because both my parents work for the Forest Service. They're very active in fire, and they've gone out in fires and done stuff like that. And my aunt down south, she's also a volunteer fire department. And so then I always see her go out on calls and stuff like that, and I've always thought it would be interesting to see what it's like and get the experience and stuff.
Firefighter Paul Jennings helped come up with the junior program. Jennings says their approach in training the younger volunteers is not much different than for the adults.
Last year, we ended up bringing these juniors through the Firefighter 1 with the adults, and they had very few limitations. We found out that we were able to do almost anything and everything that the adults did.
One of the only limits on junior volunteers is that they can't go into burning buildings, but there's a lot more they can do, according to Lieutenant Troy Tinas, another program organizer.
There's a lot to be done besides just running into a burning building or going taking a hose line into the building. They can man hose lines themselves from the exterior of the building and provide exposure protection for surrounding buildings. They can bring us tools. They can pull hoses for us.
On drill nights like these, they practice setting up equipment and responding to mock fire scenes around town. About 20 adult and junior volunteers gathered together in the briefing room as Fire Marshal Ryan Weldy explained the scenario for the evening.
And just like last week, one member will hop out and take the hydrant, and the engineer will make the connection from LDH to pump.
After the short briefing, it was time for volunteers to don their protective clothing, which they call turnout gear. The junior firefighters get the same gear as the adults. And they were soon on board the trucks, with lights flashing for the short ride up to the medical center, the site of the imaginary fire. The junior members join the adults. Some volunteers train on a fire hose, while Assistant Chief Dave Berg schools others in ladder techniques.
It is a two-story building, but each story is better than 12 feet high. So a 24 is not going to work for this particular building. With our simulation, a smaller ladder would work fine.
Okay. So Bynum, is it making your head spin yet?
Yeah, the adrenaline's pumping.
We're not even burning anything
yet. I know.
It takes a lot of people to fight a big fire. Even with 19 firefighters on the scene, there was plenty to do. Volunteer Fire Chief Jared Cook is hopeful the junior firefighter program could help replenish the ranks in the future as older volunteers leave the department.
There's a large number of older gentlemen in the department, and there's a big gap in the younger age group. And so my hope personally was that some of these folks, if they choose to stay in town, will stay in the department also.
High schoolers have to be at least 15 years old to take part in the junior firefighter program. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Rosemarie Alexander and Casey Kelly in Juneau and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Lori Townsend from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to Gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. Help manage subsistence hunting and fishing in Alaska. Apply for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The deadline to apply is January the 8th. For more information, call 800-478-1456. This announcement is sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Office of Subsistence Management.
Regional Council 800-478-1456. Application not humchikut January 8th dami. Unakankigun khtuk U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Office of Subsistence Management, Anchorage, Jamuk.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.